from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, could psychedelic drugs help people stay away from opioids, and for how long?
It's not just get you off the heroin. It's like it gives you it hits the reset button. That's the only way to really explain it is like a new brain, you know?
WBUR's Deborah Becker has the story. Also today, it's Wednesday, so we'll talk sports, including the now officially playoff-bound Red Sox.
A come-from-behind win, 7-2. The final win number 99 brings with it a postseason berth.
And in the middle of Boston's luxury real estate boom, a new report is raising questions about money laundering, calling on the city to think deep about the pros and cons of building the skyline.
And you just have to wonder, who's buying Boston, and how is this going to help ordinary Bostonians, or how is this not going to hurt ordinary Bostonians?
That's all coming up next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. We start the hour with a story about an alternative type of treatment to opioid addiction, one that uses doses of a psychedelic drug called ibogaine. It's illegal in the U.S., but it's available at clinics in Mexico. You may have heard the first two parts of WBUR reporter Deborah Becker's story that follows Dustin Dextrays from his home in New Hampshire to a clinic in Mexico where he was able to get the treatment for his opioid addiction. Dextrays turned to this treatment as a last resort after attempting suicide with an overdose. So yesterday we heard how the treatment in Mexico felt transformative to him. Deb also reported on how advocates say ibogaine can eliminate drug cravings for those experiencing withdrawal. And others, though, say it's dangerous and not well understood. We'll speak with Deb Becker about her reporting in a few minutes. First, let's go to New Hampshire, where Dextrays has returned home from Mexico after his ibogaine treatment.
Hey, what's up, buddy?
I just went inside!
36-year-old Dustin Dextrays is reuniting with his children after returning to New Hampshire for more than a week in Mexico. He was getting addiction treatment with the psychedelic ibogaine.
You want a piece of watermelon?
Yes, please.
Here you go.
Dextrays calls ibogaine a miracle and says he's never felt better.
Not just 100%, 110%. Like, I'm totally okay with myself. I'm not trying to escape life anymore. I've never felt this way in my whole entire life.
His experience is similar to what hundreds of people have said about ibogaine, that it completely eliminates opioid withdrawal symptoms and cravings. And Dextrays says it's even more than that.
It's not just get you off the heroin. It's like it gives you it hits the reset button. That's the only way to really explain it is like a new brain, you know?
Scientists don't know exactly how ibogaine affects the brain or how long it lasts. The research on it is limited, largely because it's classified as an illegal drug in the U.S. and it has safety risks. But one longtime researcher says his studies suggest that after taking it, people appear able to refrain from drugs at first.
My best representative guess would be that it's usually in the range of about 1 to 3 months of diminished drug use.
Dr. Kenneth Alper, associate professor of psychiatry and neurology at NYU, has been studying ibogaine for about 20 years. He says taking ibogaine is just a first step, and long-term support afterward is needed.
People need to use this opportunity to restructure their lives.
Dextrays, for example, knows that he is now just starting the hard work of recovery. He and the clinic staff in Mexico came up with some options for what he would do when he came home. Dextrays has chosen to go to counseling and attend support meetings. Although less than a month after ibogaine, he says he only needs minimal support.
I think now it's to help other people. That's why I'm going to the meetings. And by helping them, I'm helping myself because we are all one.
Dextrays also has family support. His mother, Pamela Stack, says she has her son back, and she hopes he stays.
Look at his eyes, you know. It's just a big difference. He's not trying to steal something. You know, you don't have to watch him that he's going to walk out of here with whatever he feels like, because he has done that many times.
But ibogaine does not work for everyone.
It ended up not working for my daughter.
Kathleen Cochran sent her daughter to Mexico for ibogaine treatment 3 years ago. She says the psychoactive experience caused visions of unresolved childhood trauma, and there was no support to help her daughter deal with it. Her 27-year-old daughter is now stable on methadone. Cochran says people should be wary of alternative medicine in foreign countries.
My advice would be to wait until Ibogaine is legal in the United States and surround yourself with experts that are able to deal with the aftermath of the trauma.
Ibogaine opponents often point to stories like Cochran's. Harvard Medical School professor Dr. Bertha Madras says psychedelics can be dangerous because not enough is known about how they affect those with mental health conditions. Dr. Madras says she understands that the opioid epidemic has made many people feel desperate, but she says there's already treatment in this country that's backed by strong scientific research.
What they should not be desperate for is a quick fix, because high-quality treatment centers do exist in this country, and that's where they should be flocking to, as opposed to places that have undocumented data and anecdotal evidence. I just think it's fraught with hazard.
Dr. Madras also points to the health risks. At least 19 deaths have been attributed to Ibogaine use between 1990 and 2008, most because a patient had another health problem or because the Ibogaine was not administered under medical supervision. Ibogaine proponents say that's exactly why the U.S. should do more studies. Rick Doblin, founder of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, says there's renewed interest in and acceptance of psychedelic medicine in general, and for addiction, more research would be worth the risks.
The risk of untreated addiction is terrible as well, more terrible than the risks of Ibogaine administered under medical supervision.
Scientists say even if research on Ibogaine were to begin in this country, it would take another 8 to 10 years before it might be available.
That's WBUR senior correspondent Deborah Becker. You may have heard her also hosting Morning Edition today. So a bit earlier, I asked her to give us some insight into how she reported this series, beginning with how she found Dustin Dextre's.
I had been reading a lot about Ibogaine when I had been doing research about addiction treatment, and there were a lot of addiction blogs and addiction sites where folks were mentioning this psychedelic treatment for addiction and that it had removed people's withdrawal symptoms and drug cravings. So I started asking people, do you know of anyone who's done this treatment, either underground or in another country because it's illegal in the United States?
And opioid treatment or opioid addiction has been your beat for a long time.
Right, right. So I talked with my editors, and I said I would like to do this story, and they said, well, we have to use their name. We would be willing to send you to the clinic to do it, but we want to use their name, and we want them to be able to talk about their journey. So it was very difficult to find people who would say, yes, I will let you follow me to another country where I'm taking psychedelics for my opioid addiction. So I did find some people. Unfortunately, as the story pointed out, many folks come to Ibogaine after, as a last resort, after they've pretty much exhausted conventional treatment. And some of the folks that I had identified who were interested in going actually didn't actually make it to Mexico for treatment because they overdosed before they got there.
They fatally overdosed.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. It's an opioid epidemic. It's a very serious thing. And I think some people get to a very desperate place and conventional treatment doesn't work and they do this.
So that's a question. Is Ibogaine a desperate measure in that it's not proven to be safe, but it is effective for some? So what do we know?
Well, what we know is that many people report, as Dustin, our protagonist in our story, reports, that it took away his drug cravings and it took away his withdrawal symptoms. And that's been reported for decades. It's very controversial. However, also heart risks have been reported from Ibogaine, and folks have died from taking it, and that is also known. So, you know, it's unclear, and it's illegal in this country because it is a psychedelic. So there's not a lot of solid scientific evidence on it. Much of the scientific evidence that does exist is based on surveys of people who've taken it. But we don't know an awful lot about it.
Right. What was it like in Mexico being treated medically and otherwise?
Well, it's really interesting because medical tourism is such a big deal in Mexico. A lot of people go to Mexico for medical treatments. It's less expensive than in this country many times. Easier to get sometimes. You know, you can get it faster. So there's billboards everywhere advertising medical treatment for folks from the U.S., you know, English billboards. So that being said, the fact that Ibogaine is not illegal in Mexico is interesting, but it's not sanctioned. So it's not like you go to a hospital to get it. You go to clinics. It's unclear how many of these clinics there are. It's unclear how many people are going to these clinics. Although I spoke with various clinic directors there, they estimate that there are at least 24 of these clinics in Mexico, that they've seen thousands of patients, and more than 95% are from the United States.
And this is so off the grid, maybe, that there's no central area of research or database keeping track of how many people have used treatment, right? Success, not success.
Right. We have no idea.
No data.
There's no data on numbers, who's successful, how they're successful, although many of these clinics want to do it. But it's very interesting. I spoke with one person who ran a clinic in Mexico and was so concerned about safety because it was being threatened if he didn't pay off people to continue to operate that he had to close. So it's a little dicey. It's not just the fact that the medication itself can be risky. It's dicey about where you're getting this type of treatment.
And Dustin Dextrace is recently home. These pieces aired over the course of this week on WBUR. What do we know about the long-term proven effects, the success rates of using Ibogaine as a treatment?
The doctors in Mexico say that, and it seems pretty consistent with some of the research, that about 40 to 50% of the folks who take Ibogaine are able to stay off drugs long term. Some of the doctors believe that Ibogaine eliminates drug cravings for about 90 days. And they say folks should use that time, patients should use that time to restructure their lives while the cravings are eliminated. So that's what the science says about those things.
Is there research going on anywhere in pharmaceuticals in the U.S. among companies that is trying to replicate anything that they understand about how Ibogaine works on receptors on with addiction?
There is a pharmaceutical company, Savant HWP, and it is actually looking and testing a synthetic version of Ibogaine that would mimic its properties to reduce withdrawal symptoms, but would take away the psychoactive aspect. So they would remove the controversial part of the tripping, if you will. But of course, the Ibogaine proponents say the tripping is as important as the removal of withdrawal because the mental clarity received during a mystical experience helps people as well.
Right. And that's a hard sell, I imagine, on the FDA.
right.
On others who are running more traditional clinics using methadone, using buprenorphine. It's not clear, though, anytime soon, any kind of replication through a pharmaceutical or any kind of clearance from the FDA for Ibogaine at all is happening. It's not anytime soon.
No, it isn't expected to happen anytime soon. I think, you know, these tests by Savant HWP for a synthetic compound that does not have psychoactive properties is one step, but one researcher suggested that even if testing were to begin in this country, it would be 10 years away, probably before anything came to market.
So, Deb, we meet people when we report on them, and we end up caring about them even though we are supposed to be outside. I mean, you watched a man go through something very, very personal, very intimate, physical, tripping. We don't always get to revisit their stories. Do you know if you'll get to follow Dustin Dextrace to find out what happens next in his life?
I'm assuming I will follow him. I'm in touch with Dustin, and we spent an awful lot of time together. So we are in touch, and yes, I'd like to continue to follow him, although at this point I don't have a specific plan to do that.
That's WBUR senior correspondent Deb Becker. Thank you so much. It's good to see you.
You're welcome.
Sometimes when we think about the women who have impacted our lives, food comes to mind. That's why one Boston-based artist is using food to bring total strangers together for a very intimate dinner party. It's a gathering that serves as a space to remember the women who have shaped us. WBUR artery reporter Maria Garcia went to that dinner party, and here's what she experienced.
On a recent Saturday evening, I arrived to a large art studio at the Carpenter Center for the Visual Arts at Harvard. There are canvases, paints, and all kinds of art supplies. But in the middle of the room rests a long table with fresh flowers and little tea lights that give the room a warm, soft amber glow.
I wanted to create a space that's not part of our everyday, to create a shared space of exchange.
That's artist Evelyn Ritz. She's been organizing these meetups for women around Boston for a couple of years now. It's a nomadic project meant to put total strangers together for an evening of intentional intimacy.
There is something special that happens in careful listening, really close attention. Mm-hmm. And I think the way we interact on our day-to-day basis doesn't always require that kind of listening.
The project is called Comida Casera, Spanish for homemade food. Each woman brings a dish inspired by another woman, from mother, mentor, to friend, who reminds them of home or gives them the feeling of home.
I think there's a lot of both trust and generosity in the act of sharing food and eating a stranger's food, both trusting that, you know, you're eating somebody's food who you've never met.
Daisy Nam brings rice cakes made from mugwort, a plant used in Korean cuisine. The dish is inspired by her grandmother.
In the late 80s, she came to live with us from Korea, and she was just a strange person and kind of mean and cranky, and we just didn't know what to think of her.
Daisy remembers her grandmother yanking the flowers out of her home's garden.
She just thought it was funny in America that people would grow things that they would never eat. And she's like, that's ridiculous. Why would you do that? So she just like took out all her flowers. She's like, you can't eat this, so why would you grow it?
After tearing the flowers out from their garden, Daisy's grandmother planted mugwort and later made rice cakes with it.
She raised my father and his four sister siblings all by herself. She survived the Korean War. She survived Japanese occupation. I mean, we thought she was crazy, but she's just a survivor. So I think I wanted to channel that.
Cristina Aguilera, originally from Venezuela, also brings a dish inspired by her grandmother.
We call it tajadas. It's just like fried plantain. Has anyone had... I love the reaction because I didn't have to like put a lot of effort in it, and everybody was like,
Sharing the plantains with others reminds Cristina of her family life in Venezuela and missing her grandmother.
I miss her a whole lot. I knew this was going to happen because I've been just nostalgic of that. I mean, she's in Venezuela and I haven't been able to go for like 3 years.
The night isn't just about grandmothers. Mel Tang brings mango and rice balls in honor of her roommate and best friend.
When I first met Morgan, it was really special because she is totally a glutton and she can eat a lot and I can eat a lot.
For Mel, the dinner is also a bittersweet reminder of her relationship with her sister.
For me, I have an older sister named Monica, but we are not close at all. And I'm going to get emotional, but we haven't talked in almost 2 years. And this is the kind of thing that we would love to eat and make together. And it makes me very sad that we haven't connected and we can't enjoy this kind of food.
There are women at the dinner from China, Turkey, Cambodia, Italy, and beyond. After we eat, laugh, and cry, I realize there's been a catharsis, that these women have unloaded some real feelings here about home, about the beautiful and complicated nature of families, about what they take from the women in their lives and what they shed. Here's Evelyn again, the artist who organizes Comida Casera.
It's not an event about networking. It is an event about creating friendships, and there's a kind of shared sisterhood in a way of these women you don't know when you first sit down at the table. They're mostly strangers. But by the end, you feel like you know everyone pretty well because you've connected through not small talk, but something bigger, something more meaningful.
As for me, I brought tacos, a piece of Mexico, of my family, of the women who love me and raised me, of home.
That's WBUR's Maria Garcia. For more coverage of the local art scene and to see photos of the dinner, check out the artery section of WBUR.org. Stay with us. Coming up, Red Sox, NFL, and Serena Williams will break down what's been an exciting week in sports. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston.
Thank you.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. It's Wednesday, which means it's time to talk sports. And here with us for that is WBUR's Chris Siderick. Welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And a producer here, by the way. Let's just make this clear. All right. So I believe there is some good news about the Red Sox.
I've got great news if you like October baseball. The Red Sox are playoff bound once again. It's their third straight year. They locked that up by beating Toronto last night 7-2. And I just want to give some context to this year because there's been a lot of talk about how historic this season has been. That brings their record to 99-46 with 16 games left to play. The franchise record for wins all time ever is 105. So they have a shot to do that. That was way back in 1912. So there's a real chance to make some history here. They'll start to try to do that by going for win 100 tonight. David Price will take the mound in the final of a three-game series with Toronto. And I'm sure, Jill, you're wondering, what about the Yankees, right?
Oh, I am wondering what about the Yankees, because you can't wonder about the Red Sox without wondering
exactly,
about the Yankees.
Exactly.
I know this. Even I know this.
So they've got a 9-game lead on the Yankees. That means the magic number with 16 to play is now 9 left. Magic number, of course, means a combination of Red Sox wins and Yankees losses. Once that adds up to 9, they have locked down the division title. That's huge because a few years ago, baseball kind of restructured the way they do the playoffs, and the two wildcard teams now have to play a 1-game play-in to the playoffs. The division teams get to go right to that first divisional round. So winning your division is a huge advantage and hopefully something the Red Sox are headed towards.
That is something I did not know, but I have to say this. You may say that this is an historic season, but ever since I moved to New England in 1981, 82, the gnashing of teeth is September. You know, it's just, it's, this
well,
is not
a,
new.
Well, there's a little bit of a history there.
Okay, there is a history there. And then there was a great moment somewhere after 2001, if I believe.
I
can't remember what year that was.
Panic button. People know what you're talking
about. This is the season of gnashing of teeth, no matter what, as we go into October baseball, clearly. Yeah. So the Red Sox win 7-2 last night. It sounds like a blowout, basically.
It sounds that way, but it wasn't quite so much. Basically, they could not get the offense going last night, and they found themselves down 2-0 going into the bottom of the seventh inning. They finally started to get a little bit of offensive momentum going. Steve Pierce hits a triple. They've got runners on first and third. And so Alex Cora, the coach, knows he's going to pinch hit for the catcher, Sandy Leon, who's been struggling. He's got Mitch Moreland in the on-deck circle, ready to pinch hit. And as Moreland starts to walk up to the plate to take the at-bat, Cora suddenly calls him back. There's a little bit of a scramble in the Red Sox dugout, and here comes Brock Holt.
2-2 on Brock Holt.
So the Red Sox try to steal a run here, too. There they go.
Runner goes Nunez. High fly ball right field. Deep into the corner. Grichuk long run, and it is gone! How about that?
I think Cora made the right decision.
I guess he did make the right decision. It's such a joy to listen to Joy on the field, that is. So why didn't Cora have Holt in there to begin with?
Well, to be honest, Moreland's a better hitter, which makes what happened last night all the more surprising. And here's a little crash course on baseball for you. If you're a right-handed hitter, you would rather face a left-handed pitcher. Has to do with the arm angle. If you're a right-handed hitter on the right side of the plate, I'm throwing with my right hand. It's harder to pick up the ball than if it's coming across my body from the other side. So Moreland's in the on-deck circle. Cora sees that Toronto has a left-handed pitcher in the bullpen ready to go if they do pinch hit Moreland. So basically you put the left-handed Moreland in, here comes the left-handed Toronto pitcher, and Cora's got to then pinch hit for the pinch hitter already. And he decided he'd rather save Moreland for later in the game in case they need him, sends out Brock Holt, and obviously the rest is history. Brock Holt takes it deep, and they end up winning the game. All the more surprising, Brock Holt, not a power hitter. He's got 4 home runs on the year, 2 of those pinch hit home runs, which is incredibly difficult to come in cold off the bench. You're not warmed up. You're not locked in. And to hit 2 home runs for a guy who's not a home run hitter, he's the first Red Sox player ever to hit 2 pinch hit home runs in a season.
Wow, this sounds as complex as getting a daily talk show out the door, if not even more. But I so appreciate your energy around this. I'm not a sports fan, as you all know, or as now you all know out there. But I follow vaguely, and the energy and the insight you have into plays, it just always amazes me. Anybody, it's sort of like the same thing with Monty Python movies, I think, for some.
Oh, don't get me started.
I
won't. We'll be doing quotes
I had this
the
feeling.
Segment.
Okay, so it was obviously a great win last night.
What?
It was obviously a great win last night. Is there anything else we were missing? Anything else worth noting?
Big point in the game. Chris Sale is back for the first time since August 12th. He went 1 inning through 26 pitches. They thought about bringing him back for a second inning, but basically Alex Cora didn't want to push it too hard. They had him throw a few more pitches in the bullpen just to stay loose. Chris Sale talked after the game about how great it was to be back, though he was a little anxious.
Just trying to throw strikes. I mean, it's my first time back out there in a while.
sped up a little bit on me. I feel like I was kind of rushing a little bit, kind of got out of some of the things that I need to do to stay on top of things. But, ended up getting out of it. Obviously relied on my bullpen a little bit more than I'd like to, but, we move on.
So this part's pretty obvious probably when you're talking about one of, if not the best pitcher in baseball this season. But Chris Sale's going to be huge for this team if the Sox are going to make a deep run in the playoffs.
All right, we will be watching. Even I will be watching. let's talk about football for a bit. The Patriots started the season with a win on Sunday. Anything jump out from that game?
Well, coming into the year, the big concern was the wide receiver position. Philip Dorsett in his second year had a great game, so if he can maintain that, that'll be great. The team is obviously still concerned about the receiver position. They signed three new players this week. Two of those were receivers. The other thing that kind of jumped out at me from Sunday is that rookie linebacker Juwan Bentley looks like he could be an absolute stud on the defensive side of the ball. He called the plays for them this preseason, which is pretty interesting to see a rookie take that kind of responsibility. And he actually played more downs on Sunday than fellow linebacker Dante Hightower, who was actually the team captain. So I expect big things from him this year.
All right. So pulling away from the field of football and out into the culture of the NFL, it has been an interesting time, obviously, for some time now. The Nike ad that's just come out with Colin Kaepernick, the story from last week that brought the anthem issue again front and center. Is that a story you think is going to stick around, or do you think that now that the season is underway, the game can be focused on, we'll move back to looking at the actual game?
I'd like to say it's going away, but I don't think it is. We're still seeing all these calls for Nike boycotts, though it's worth mentioning that their sales are up about 30% since they launched the Kaepernick ad campaign. So I don't know if the boycotts are effective. We have seen one school, a private Christian school, the College of the Ozarks in Missouri, basically got rid of their Nike uniforms that had the Nike logo on them. But most schools are pretty locked into their long-term contracts with the company. I did think it was interesting. There was a video going around online that Reverend Mac Morris at a Baptist church in Mobile, Alabama, actually made a big deal of cutting up some Nike gear, a Nike headband and a Nike sweatband during his sermon on Sunday.
America may not be the best country in the world, and we've got a lot of faults, but I'm telling you what, a lot of folks died for the sake of what that flag represents.
So in terms of actual protests, you had a couple of Miami Dolphins that took a knee during the anthem, one other player who raised a fist. Not a ton of protests around the league, but it's obviously an issue that people on both sides feel really, really passionately about.
So we're not going to have time to talk about these other NFL players who are raising political issues, but I just want to flag that there are other players out there who are, you know, who are raising issues. It's called the Players Coalition. They're not getting nearly as much attention as a group of players. They don't have Nike ads, but maybe we can get back to them.
Yeah, they were actually one of the driving forces behind the deal with the NFL last year for that $90 million towards social justice programs. There's some tension in the group about kind of what the actual ultimate goal is and kind of the messaging behind it. Again, an issue like this where you have people that feel so passionately, obviously you're going to have a differencing of opinions.
Right. And we got the Eagles, Seahawks, players from the Patriots, Redskins. I mean, it is a coalition of players who are trying to bring about some change, social issue change. All right. So let us talk a bit more about Serena Williams. There is more to say. There's always more to say about stories that blew up the way situations that blew up that way that one did last Saturday. We talked about it Monday. What is new in the story about this amazing tennis player and an umpire?
Yeah, this has been a really interesting conversation to watch. Initially, you had kind of the immediate reaction, everybody coming to Serena Williams' defense. The United States Tennis Association President Katrina Adams and the Women's Tennis Association CEO Steve Simon both kind of came out really strongly and supported Williams with statements. The umpire himself actually has spoken for the first time in his native Portuguese, so I'm not going to try to quote that. But basically said, "I'm fine, don't worry about me." Fellow umpires are starting to come forward now and saying that they don't feel that he's getting the kind of support he deserved for handling a really tough situation. And in fact, the International Tennis Federation, which is Ramos's employer, put out a statement in support of Ramos that said, quote, "Ramos undertook his duties as an official according to the relevant rule book and acted at all times with professionalism and integrity."
All right. So there are others coming to his defense, including Martina Navratilova. I think we're not going to stop to listen to this right now because we have to get on to another story today. But there is a lot out there, and the fallout will continue somewhat. I think what I've been synthesizing is that it gets too simplistic out there in the Twitter land, that there's a lot of nuance to what an umpire has to do. There's a lot going on in the body and the mind of an athlete.
Yeah, and especially a sport like tennis, which is so focused on tradition and kind of maintaining that. You've got some really convoluted rules involving when coaches can and can't give their players feedback. I think hopefully they'll take a look at that. And I think there is a legitimate question about whether or not women and men are held to different standards in terms of penalties. Ultimately, the Martina Navratilova piece you're talking about in the New York Times, her main message was, it's possible to talk about those double standards and to try to fix those issues with the game, while at the same time recognizing that Serena Williams might have gone too far in her behavior.
All right. I know we'll stay on it with you in the mixed. Thank you so much, Chris Siderik. You are a radio Boston producer and a sportsman, of course. Stay with us. Listeners, there's more ahead. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. When the average house or condo is bought or sold, the real estate transaction is public. When so-called luxury units are purchased, those are multi-million dollar units, according to a new report, there may be less transparency about the buyer. The Institute for Policy Studies, a 50-plus-year-old progressive think tank based in Washington, D.C., is raising flags about Boston's luxury housing boom. And this is at a time when Boston has multi-million-dollar units for sale in new buildings and in future buildings. The report raises questions about whether Boston is becoming a hub for, among other things, money laundering, and whether the city's skyline is being taken over by developers who will increase land values and thus housing costs around the city. Chuck Collins is in the studio. He's an author of the report and the director of the program on inequality and the common good at the Institute for Policy Studies. Chuck, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Jill.
And David B. Gelfer is also here. He's the CEO of the Commercial Real Estate Development Association, also called, though it doesn't match up, NAIOP Massachusetts, which represents the interests of real estate developers. Welcome to you.
A pleasure to be here.
Glad you both can be here. Chuck Collins, I'd like to start with you. This report is raising flags. I'd like you to lay them out. And then David B. Gelfer, of course, we'd like to get your response after that. So lay this out. What are the concerns?
Well, we took a look at this luxury real estate boom in Boston, which obviously has some benefits. It's it's construction jobs, it's tax revenue, it's portion of that can be pulled into affordable housing. But we raised a bunch of what we call perils, potential risks. One of them is that it contributes to growing inequality that already exists in Boston, that it may have an adverse effect on affordable housing in other neighborhoods, pushing up land values. Huge amounts of resources going into creating this luxury housing, and that's pushing the affluent into other neighborhoods. And we're seeing in neighborhoods like the Fenway in East Boston, spiraling upward costs and potential.
Well, you're saying there's a trickle-over effect, meaning that those who are not living in the high-rises are now moving into other neighborhoods, that's affecting housing in other neighborhoods.
That's right. Okay. So as someone who lives in a neighborhood in Boston and has for 30 years, I've been noticing that there are obviously trends and ups and downs in the real estate market, but what's happening is there's sort of a supercharging of the current market by global capital. And this is why it's sort of a new dynamic here. So what our report looks at is who's buying these luxury units. And really in a nutshell, we looked at 12 buildings, about 1,800 units. We know that 2/3 of those units are being purchased by people who don't take a residential property exemption. So they're basically saying, we're not going to take the tax break. This isn't our owner. This isn't our home. And the other interesting fact is that 1/3 of those units are being purchased by shell corporations, LLCs, many of them incorporated in Delaware, so they're obscuring their owners.
Okay, so I do want to ask you to just clarify this. At the conclusion of this report, you said that you, the authors, have examined multiple perils of what that's a forward thing, what could happen in Boston's luxury housing boom, and that with further examination, you could uncover more information about who is buying in Boston. So is this report conclusive, though, when you say you know who's buying or actually don't know who's buying, that these are unnamed buyers?
Oh, well, yeah, we don't know the actual individuals. And in fact, in the case of 1/3 of them, they're choosing to use property ownership ways to hide or mask ownership.
So just to be clear, so the data that you have is you are saying that there is a third of these units thus far purchased, however many there are, okay, that are unknown because of LLCs or whatever, yeah, whoever's doing the purchasing. So David B. Gelfer from the developer side. So developers are not new to hearing these issues, I imagine. They have not been just first raised in this report, but I imagine they've been pulled together as a flag, a large flag. Are they being spoken about by developers? And is it a responsibility for the developers to consider any of these ideas? Let's remember the city of Boston is not in this room with us, and I'm sure that there's a whole role that the city of Boston plays too.
Well, I think there are a couple things to say. First of all, just regarding the ownership factor, the fact that someone uses a trust is not a means to avoid hiding who is the actual owner of the property. Trusts are used all the time. They're used for estate purposes. My home is owned in a trust for my wife. There's many reasons to have trust. Same thing with corporations. Delaware is a place where corporations, because it's a low cost to be able to have a corporation there, but the primary purpose is not necessarily to hide the ownership. It is a means of transaction. More importantly, I think we're talking here about what is the problem. I think the problem that we have is a issue of affordable housing and lack of affordable housing, lack of middle-income housing. There's no question about that. But what we're looking at also is the fact that these high-rise buildings are producing affordable housing. There's a requirement for them to produce 15% or more, in some cases up to 50% of affordable middle-income housing. If you're developing an office building, you have linkage payments that go directly into an affordable housing fund. So we are already being taxed, if you will, for developments to produce affordable housing in the city. But for these projects going forward, those monies would not be available. As far as displacement, let's take a look at where a lot of this is occurring. For example, the Ink Block, where Boston Herald used to be. That was much more of an industrial type of area.
And that's on the edge of the South End, South before
right,
you
exactly.
go to South Boston.
And the Flower Exchange is a potential
right.
for expansion of that there. These are areas that have no housing, have never had housing.
But what's going up on Albany Street at the Flower Exchange, I believe, is science industry.
It's industry, but also there's going to be housing nearby and associated with that. The same thing with expansion of the areas there. Boston Landing, another area that was really basically warehousing, has been going into commercial as well as multifamily. The point being here is that we are not displacing affordable housing tenants. We are actually being able to provide housing for them, and this is a means to do it. Also, one other important point. If you didn't build these high-rise projects on a high price tag, they wouldn't be built at all because the costs of construction are so high that the only way that you can really produce something is for the high end.
So Chuck, you said this even in the report and just in here, there are some benefits to having a city in a building boom. What are you asking though of the city, I imagine, and the developers to pay attention to more so? Like, what is a key thing here? Because this is the way cities grow. We know this. We know this is what is happening in New York City, in Dallas. You know, whether we want this city to become a high rise city is something else. It's another story, another day. But this is growth. So if the developers are not doing it, or as they do it, what do you want to see happen?
Well, I guess I would like to see more affordable housing being built, not necessarily through what John Kenneth Galbraith called the sort of the trickle down, you know, feeding the horses to feed the sparrows, meaning we're building all this luxury housing. We hope that some of that will somehow trickle down and have positive benefits for ordinary Bostonians. I think partly because of this global capital moving in and disrupting our local market, that is going to be harder and harder. And it's interesting, you don't have to take it from me, the Boston Business Journal today has an editorial basically saying, from a business perspective, this luxury housing boom, this focus on foreign buyers is actually bad for businesses in Boston. And they echo the same recommendations in our report. This is the Boston Business Journal. Representing a segment of employers who are saying, we can't house our workers, we can't afford, our managers can't live in the greater Boston areas, our commutes are longer and longer.
Is that because of the development of expensive, really expensive condominiums, or because there may be absentee ownership?
No, it's a combination of, it's huge numbers of units that actually aren't for people to live in. Right? These are wealth storage units.
So then let's go right yeah. to this topic of what is called by you wealth storage units, absentee ownership, maybe money laundering. David, did you want to jump in here?
Let's be careful about this. The fact that people do not take an exemption does not mean that they're not living there. Now, that may not be their primary residence. For example, let's go to a high end. Michael Dell purchased a very expensive unit. He doesn't live here, but he does live
Michael
here.
Michael Dell of Dell
Computer, who bought EMC.
And I'm sorry, David, you are slightly off microphone. We're working to fix that, but you are definitely audible, so keep going.
So, for example, Michael Dell is here. How often is he here? I would not say he's here 5 months, 6 months. He's probably here on a sporadic basis. Do we want to say that's wrong? We don't want to have people like him come here who have businesses and who are growing and providing enormous numbers of jobs? Obviously, we want to be able to have people like that. We have people who are basically residents of Florida now because of tax purposes who spend 5-6 months of the year here.
And the point is that people who are not permanent residents in a city don't pay the same taxes? Is that part of the issue?
That's correct. They don't get the exemption. So the city actually benefits from them. They're not getting a discount on their taxes. They're paying the full boat. But they also are being here. They are living here. We're not talking about a plethora of dark, you know, condominiums that are across the whole city. Boston isn't one of those communities where you walk out at night and it's dismal. There's lack of people. There's lack of it's an exciting city. Back in 1970s, when I started in the business, you'd walk downtown Boston and there would be tumbleweed newspapers floating on the street and there'd be no one it would be bumping into. We have a very vibrant city which is not being hurt by having a few units being sold to possibly some
Farmers. And Miami and New York City are very bright cities. So let me just throw out some numbers here, which came from reporting from the Washington Examiner. 30%, their reporter says, 30% of the cash purchases of high-end real estate in six major cities are by shell companies. So those are suspicious buyers. This also then trips off the Treasury Department, the Federal Treasury Department, to keep an eye on this. The Treasury Department is keeping an eye on several cities, including New York and Miami, not yet Boston. You're saying this is not a city of darkened windows. These units, many of them are occupied. Some of them, though, have been purchased by LLCs or unknown buyers, and they are empty?
Well, actually, there are many units that are bought by residents here that are bought through trusts and through corporations. Again, that is not an indicator or litmus test that you're dealing with money laundering and that there's money that's coming from illegal sources. By the way, if there is money laundering coming on, if there is illegal purchasing going on, let's bring in the law enforcement to take a look at it. I don't think we should just assume that someone who happens to buy in a LLC or a trust is all of a sudden suspect.
So I do want to ask Chuck, are you saying Boston is in jeopardy or Boston is already there in trouble?
We're theorizing about things that we can't know because part of what happens with anonymous ownership is you really don't know what's going on in a property. And David is right. People have there are legitimate reasons for using some of these ownership structures. But what they did in Miami is interesting. They investigated properties that were acquired by shell corporations with cash. And they actually zeroed in and started to monitor that. And cash transactions dropped by 85% over a year. So what does that tell us? It tells us that in the certain jurisdictions where people are actually keeping an eye on the ball, and again, the Boston Business Journal is calling for this transparency as well. We should be alarmed. See, it's a different market than the 70s and the 80s. It's a different boom than we've lived in the past because global capital, billionaires around the world are moving their money faster and faster, and they're looking for places for safe havens. They're looking to park that money in real property, just like they're buying art and other things. Mm-hmm. And Boston now, because we actually aren't looking at who's owning, we're not monitoring these red flag transactions, is at risk of being one of those illicit fund venues.
So this is where a wonderful thing that David B. Gelfer is in here, because you have been in this market for almost 30 years. You are retiring, I understand, at the end of the year. And you have seen the city change. 30 years is a long time, and many buildings have gone up and some have disappeared. So have you ever seen, could you ever have imagined seeing a luxury market like this in downtown Boston?
Well, it's been over 40 years, but who's counting?
But who's counting? I'm so sorry. 40 years.
No, it's no problem. But it gives a perspective.
You look 50. I don't know how this works.
I've gone through four recessions here. I've seen the cycles that have come and gone. But I've never seen the city and the region look so dynamic and so healthy. It has diverse businesses, industries that are here. We have some of the top leaders of tech and pharmaceutical, biotech, manufacturing. We are really going forward in a time where I've never seen anything quite like this. With this comes challenges,
And I have to absolutely agree that one of the greatest challenges we have is the cost of housing in the area. There is absolutely no question about that. The problem we have is if we stop, for instance, the construction of the high-rise condos, if you will, there isn't an alternative method to be able to produce affordable and middle-income housing.
You're saying that's based on tax, the taxes that come from the sale of these
right,
these
but properties. No, I'm going further and saying that let's say we want to build moderate-income housing. There is no funding. There is no financial sources available that will allow you to do that. Developers would love to be able to build to that market. It is a wide-open market, except the problem is with the cost of construction. The problem is that you cannot build them without deep subsidies. And the state is not coming up with them. The federal government is not coming up with it. And locally, there's a limited amount of money there. If we can increase those subsidies, obviously we can produce more.
So, Chuck, when this report came out from the Institute for Policy Studies, it's not that are you lobbying responsibility on top of the developers of these luxury buildings? Or are you saying work with us? Are you saying work with the city in a different way? What are the solutions here, I guess, or what are your recommendations?
Well, I think developers do what they have to do. They in terms of the market constraints that David is talking about, it is very difficult to create affordable housing in this market. And but I guess I would say that the city, there's more tools that the city could use. I mean, I think fortunately, we have a city that really cares about housing affordability. There is a linkage program. So we build one Dalton Place, a skyscraper, 61 stories, and we get 21 units of affordable housing out of that. Okay, so how many more one Dalton Places are we going to build before we're able to house low and middle income people in Boston? So that's where I'm just not sure the trickle-down perspective will work. I would argue there's more we could do. I think we should tax very high-end luxury transactions at the city level, maybe at the state level, and dedicate that money to affordable housing.
So spell that out for people who don't have that kind of money.
Well,
tax the buyer?
When a property sells, when a luxury property sells, so in San Francisco, when a property sells, a luxury property, there's a percentage that's taxed off the top. You know, it's paid essentially by the buyer, I suppose. But it goes into an affordable housing fund. Or in the state of Vermont, there's a real estate transfer tax, goes into conservation for rural land as well as affordable housing. We need to create new revenue streams. And to the extent that there's all this global wealth touching down in Boston, we should ask more for providing the environment, the safety box, if you will, the wealth storage unit security. We should be taxing and asking for more from those property
owners.
So
there are models of this that exist already for agricultural land. For instance, land that gets put aside, it's purchased with this sort of surtax. Is that a fair recommendation?
Well, first of all, instead of taxing at the end, we tax up front. So what happens is, it was correct in stating that in Dalton Place, you have a certain number of units that are set aside. I personally think that's a mistake. I think that those units are, you're giving 20 people or 21 people a lottery to get into a luxury building there in a great part of the Back Bay. If you took that money instead of units and took that as money and put that into leveraging it into neighborhoods, you could produce probably 100 units, 125 units of moderate income housing. So having it right within the building that you are developing, I mean, it's nice to say that, you know, we now have a mixed income within the building. But if you want to produce units, it's better to be able to go into a neighborhood where land costs are less and you're able to be able to build at a lesser cost per square foot.
And
I just want to clarify, those units aren't in one Dalton Place.
Okay.
Are there units that are affordable middle income units in these buildings?
Some of them are. For instance, in the condominiums that were built at the there was a number of units that were built in that place. I think there were 6 units that were built. That could have really been leveraged out to a lot more units.
It's the Mandarin Oriental?
Mandarin, okay. Thank you. I'm sorry for that. But that is a chance to be able to have taken that money and to really to have been able to leverage it out elsewhere. Look, the bottom line here is that it is a challenge, and it's not just a challenge for Boston. It is a challenge, you know, across this country, figuring out how to produce middle-income and moderate-income housing. It is a challenge for us because with a virtually full employment, if we can't attract people from out of state, and we do have them come here, but we lose them in greater numbers than they're coming domestically, if we can't change those numbers and be able to provide housing for more people, workers,
we can't increase our economy.
All right, we've got about a minute left. I just want to lay out a couple of things. That there is a call by Mayor Marty Walsh that for the Treasury Department to add Boston to its list of cities it's watching for the kinds of transactions that are considered laundering of money. Also that there is ongoing efforts to find ways to make and build or provide middle low income housing in the city. The question is, in 30 seconds, you know, are your groups ever going to work together? You've raised the flags. You've put out a report that is provocative because it's making us talk about housing, right? And yet, and these buildings are going up, and this is the way cities go. Is there any working together?
Well, I think we all want the same thing, to be honest with you, and that's what we want to be able to have more affordable and middle-income housing in Boston. You need to have that to have a healthy city. It needs to have diversity, both economically as well as other, you know, measures. To do that, we're going to have to be able to figure out ways to being able to create this housing. It is unlikely that that housing is going to be produced in downtown Boston. But in the suburbs and in the neighborhoods, yes.
Maybe. Then we have transportation issues. Chuck Collins, what's your take on this?
Thousands of units of luxury housing is not going to solve the affordable housing crisis. We need a very different approach. We're not going to build our way out of this by adding luxury housing. We need a different strategy.
All right. Thank you both so much. Chuck Collins from the Institute for Policy Studies, David B. Gelfer, the CEO of the Commercial Real Estate Development Association, NAIOP Massachusetts. Thank you both very much. This is Radio Boston.
Thanks, Jill.
Pleasure to be here.